So how did you get to write this book?
I'd been a war reporter for a long time, and I got out because my colleague Tim Hetherington was killed. He and I made Restrepo together. We shot it, directed it, produced it together. And that forced me to sort of think back on my life a bit and think back about this amazing world. I'd been narrowly focused on war, but I realized I had a much more complex, rich topic in front of me if I chose. And what I wanted to look at was basically modern society. And I'd been thinking about the blessings and the hardships of modern society really my whole life. I studied anthropology in college. I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation. I was a good long-distance runner in college, and I trained with the very best Navajo runners. They're amazing runners.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I had a mentor when I was young. His name was Ellis. He was half Lakota, half Apache. And he said to me at one point, he said, you know, it's funny, throughout the history of this country, along the frontier, the white people were always running off to join the Indians, but the Indians never ran off to join the white people. And he went on to say that modern society is very, very hard on the human psyche. And that always stuck in my mind. And much later, when I was in Afghanistan, I was surprised to see that many of the soldiers I was with at this remote outpost called Restrepo, after they'd been back for a month or two, in Vicenza, where they're based, after this brutal deployment, they were going to ship back to the United States, and a lot of them didn't want to go back. They wanted to return to Restrepo, to this godforsaken hillside just with tarantulas and scorpions and combat. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of what Ellis had said, like no one wants to go home to modern society. And I decided to pursue that idea and see if there was something to it.
Yeah. So what is it when they are part of this group that happens to them? I mean, it's not just not coming home. It must be some draw about being part of this group.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's appalling about home is that there isn't the kind of close communal bonds available that you have in combat. Now, keep in mind, we're primates. Humans are primates. We're a social species. We have... as a species, lived most of the last 2 million years in groups of 30, 40, 50 individuals. There was no individual survival outside of group survival. It was one and the same thing. As a result, humans get all of their emotional needs met by the people immediately around them. And that has been true until very, very recently. So if you take a 20-year-old and put him in uniform and send him off to Afghanistan, he's in a platoon. The platoon I was with was all men, so I'm going to keep saying he. He winds up in a situation of in a remote place with 30, 40 men that he's completely dependent on for his survival and for his emotional needs, doing everything together, sleeping together, eating together, doing missions together. That reproduces our evolutionary past almost exactly. And it feels good. We're wired for that. That clearly works for humans on a psychological and social level.
So it taps into a very primal state of existence, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we're wired for as a species. And then you take that person, you pick them up, and you drop them back down in the great American suburb, and it's a profoundly alienating and, frankly, frightening experience if you're used to the psychological and physical security of a small, tightly bonded group.
Yeah, so what happens to these guys when they keep going back or when they come back into our society? I mean, two questions. What happens when they keep going back and can't find what they need here in the country?
Well, I think, ironically, they feel safer on the front line. They feel safer because safety comes from the proximity of others, and that is deeply wired into us. And when you're sleeping by yourself or with your wife or husband in an air-conditioned room in a suburb all alone, ironically, even though you're in an environment that's physically not dangerous, it feels dangerous because you're alone. And that ancient human wiring has a huge effect on how we feel, even in places that are supposedly safe. So what happens? They go back to war, they go back to the front lines, and they feel at home, they feel good. Then they come back to this country, and they feel depressed, alienated, in danger. One of the interesting things about soldiers is that only around 10% of the U.S. military is actively engaged in combat. The other 90% have very important roles, but they're support roles, and they're really not getting traumatized regularly or firing their weapons at other people or whatever. And but a much greater percentage than 10% come back to this country and feel like they don't fit in, feel depressed, feel alienated. And we just call it PTSD because that's the word that we're – that's the sort of current word right now. But actually, I think it's a clumsy diagnosis for what really is a broad range of emotional reactions to the return.
You wanted to call it – or you talked about alienation. I like the change to post-deployment alienation syndrome or disorder. What are the symptoms of like alienation as opposed to stress or stress disorder?
Trauma is a very specific thing, and keep in mind as we're mammals, we're primates, we're humans, we are wired, we are adapted to survive hardship and trauma. I mean, if that were not true, we wouldn't exist as a species. We would not be here if trauma was psychologically incapacitating to a majority of people, incapacitating for the rest of their lives. Like, we just wouldn't exist as a species.
Wouldn't have existed after we met the first woolly mammoth we met.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
But trauma is experienced for through most of human history. Trauma was a group experience, and the recovery from trauma was a group experience. And then what we're doing with soldiers now is we're traumatizing them in a group, and then we're taking them out of that group and having them recover from trauma individually. That's not how how humans have done it. Throughout their history. And, you know, in addition, the ones who aren't traumatized are suffering the very real grief of losing that group that they were a part of when they come back to this society. This problem isn't restricted to soldiers. I mean, you could look at Peace Corps volunteers. They weren't traumatized. I mean, they were in the developing world. It was a tough life, I'm sure, for many of them for a couple of years, but they come back to this country. And around 25% of returning Peace Corps volunteers sink into a deep depression. It's exactly what happens to soldiers.
After Vietnam, I think there was a collective shame around the way that many of the returning vets were treated and received. And there's been a transformation in the way society treats vets, or at least looks at vets. And there's a lot of lionization that happens. I think you've used the term over-valorization. What do you think about the impact of that? Can you speak to what that does and when that creates a climate where we hear everyone, you know, for example, veterans that I know tell me that they get people telling them all the time, thank you for your service, but it's not necessarily meaningful when it gets repeated over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, it ends up feeling like a kind of reflexive rote sentence that feels... It actually feels like it's too. You shouldn't be able to dismiss your obligations to veterans that easily, like with one sentence.
Sure. Right?
And I mean, I think that's the problem with it. And it's like, okay, I can say this sentence, we're good, and I'll move on. And you know, frankly, I mean, the country needs soldiers, the country needs teachers, the country needs guys who drill for oils, the country needs fishermen and loggers and a lot of other stuff. Like, I mean, if you're going to go with thank you for your service, why stop at veterans? I mean, in that sense. There is something very special about veterans, but they are also part of a broader workforce that keeps this nation running. And if we're going to go with gratitude, let's keep going.
But there's something special about being a veteran and seeing war and being shot at. And I'm wondering, like, what else we could say to them?
Well, it depends on the veteran. I mean, 90% of veterans aren't shot at.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. And I think for the guys who really did not go through a combat deployment, what some would call over-valorization of them actually makes them uncomfortable. I think it's a form of stress. And there are a lot of jobs. I mean, I started out as a writer writing about dangerous jobs. And, my first book was The Perfect Storm, was about commercial fishing. You know, all those guys on that boat died. So the mortality rates and the injury rates in certain kinds of dangerous jobs in this country are as high as combat units, right? You work in an oil field. I mean, the Deepwater Horizon disaster, I think 11 guys just disappeared. They were just vaporized. I mean, imagine the other 20 or 30 on that rig.
Yeah.
Imagine their PTSD. So there's a lot of jobs that are just as dangerous as being a soldier, if not mm-hmm. more, depending on what unit you're in. There is something special about veterans. And I think what's special about veterans isn't so much that it's more dangerous than other things, is that it's politically encumbered. Like, war is politically encumbered in a way that commercial fishing just isn't. There are a lot of strong feelings about war, and you're coming back to a country that's having one massive family argument about war. And oil workers don't have to deal with that. Oil workers don't have to deal with killing people. I mean, and that's the difference.
I wonder also, though, as a army person, you have to give up your personality in some ways for the code, for the group, in ways that maybe other jobs don't really require that. So it's really like a transformation sometimes for a veteran. And I wonder if we want to thank them for that. Thank you for giving up who you were to become somebody we needed you to be, and you were shot out in this low percentage, but...
Well, I would say that, you know, boot camp, and again, I'm not a soldier, I'm a civilian observer of soldiers occasionally, but I would say that boot camp absolutely sort of wipes out your personality for a while. It is a form of initiation rite. Initiation rites in any tribal society do that for a while with its young men particularly. But once you get at a remote outpost like Restrepo, believe me, the personalities are on florid display. I mean, they're all wearing the same clothes, but that after that, like it's no different than a high school class or whatever. And so there's a transition period where, yes, the identity is squashed. After that, it just returns to being what we would recognize as a group of people.
And you make a good point, Sebastian, about war being politically encumbered. We're broadcasting here on WBAI, which is part of the Pacifica family of networks, and we are known as an anti-war station. And most people who listen to this station, most people who broadcast on this station, are anti-war. But I want to point out that when we have this conversation about war and about people who are involved in war, that it's an important conversation to have, and it's not necessarily pro-war at all. When we look at who makes up the armed forces, they're much more aligned demographically with the people that this station seeks to reach out to, whether it's, you know, socioeconomically or racially or in terms of education. You know, we have to understand who makes up the armed forces, and when we talk about what we can do to help some people who have come back from these traumatic experiences, it's important to draw the distinction between doing this work and also maybe being supportive of war, which isn't necessarily the case. I just want to put that out there for our listeners.
It's a great point. And I should say, again, as a civilian, but spent a lot of time with soldiers, the most profound sense that I've ever had of this nation, as a unified entity, was not here on these shores. It was at Restrepo. And the reason is because it is so racially varied in ways that our towns and cities are not, our communities are not. 4% of American military personnel aren't even citizens. They're immigrants. They have green cards, right? And just put that in the context of the sort of patriotic rhetoric about who's an American and who isn't. 4% of our military are not citizens. Restrepo.
Do they have their own wall? I mean, are they on the other side?
Yeah, right.
Of the
yeah,
wall?
Yeah, exactly. OP Restrepo was named after the platoon medic Juan Sebastian Restrepo, who was born in the country of Colombia and came here as a child. And, you know, in addition, you know, probably a third of the platoon was Latino, somewhere from Guam, the Philippines. Interestingly, there was one African American in the platoon. And about half the platoon was sort of middle-class white guys.
But none of that really mattered, right?
But none of it mattered, exactly. So what you see out there is this incredible socioeconomic and racial variety that is this nation. And no one cared. That's the ideals of this nation. And you don't – it's very, very hard to find that on these shores. And it was really moving to see that as an American. I was like, oh, this is what we've all been longing for. This is what this nation was built for, was to see a group of people exactly like this, all doing the same thing without regard for their racial background.
You talk about the concept of tribe, right? Tribe as small groups with similar goals, similar wishes. How can we create tribes here at home? How can we create these small groups that don't get that are small enough for everyone to know each other? And what are some examples of that? I mean, I guess you could call some workplaces our tribes.
Well, we have to be careful about the language. In an anthropological sense, tribe would refer to a really tightly affiliated group of people that depend on each other for their food, for their safety, for their shelter. The people in the workplace in modern society don't provide those things. you can use the word metaphorically and say, oh, that's my tribe. And but you have to be conscious of the fact you're being metaphorical. What's been lost aren't those groups in modern society that we affiliate with, the sports team, the office group, whatever right. it is. People do that all the time. I mean, we're wired to do it. And in fact, we make sure to do it precisely because the communal living group that has characterized human life for 2 million years, precisely because that has disappeared in modern society, we go out of our way to affiliate as fans with sports teams or the office group or whatever. So when we're talking about two different things, those affiliations are great. They're healthy. They're satisfying. Clearly people love to do it. Go for it. But the more profound problem is that if you look out your window, wherever you live, and you look around at your neighbors, the houses, the apartments, whatever it may be, chances are you are not dependent on any of those people for the food you eat or your safety, for your life. You're not dependent on them for your life. That's a greatly liberating circumstance to be in, but it's a departure from 2 million years of human evolution. So when you talk about tribe, there are replacements that we have in modern society that feel good, but that communal living group that's characterized human life for so long, that is gone, and with it, we have lost a sense of belonging and a sense of emotional and physical safety. You can regain it. Soldiers re-experience that in combat. They don't know they're re-experiencing it. They're not thinking about it in these terms. But in fact, what they're doing is having an experience out of our evolutionary past. It feels good to sleep shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of guys who have guns who will defend you with their lives and vice versa. That feels good. It actually feels better than being in a situation where there's no threat, but there's no one around you either. Like, that doesn't feel good. Ironically, that doesn't feel good. Humans don't mind hardship. They don't mind adversity. And they don't mind danger. What they mind is not belonging. That's the psychologically crippling experience for people.
So it's quite a conundrum, right? Because short of going back to the land and going back to, as you mentioned earlier, an agrarian society, which doesn't seem like it's going to happen, short of doing that, it seems like there's very few and far between are the opportunities to re-experience that sort of primal state that you've mentioned that comes out of our evolution. I mean, how can we experience that without going to war?
Well, understandably, you're asking how can we have it all? Like how can right on, you know, like let's try and have it all, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we have the benefits of a modern, I mean, the real benefits and blessings of a modern society, I mean, they're innumerable, and also regain some of that cohesion. It's a cohesion that's born of hardship and adversity. So we want to know, how can we have a good, affluent society and the benefits that come from facing adversity collectively? So it's interesting to note that when you take modern society and you collapse it, if you give it a catastrophe, people immediately band together. It happened in Katrina. It happened during the Blitz in London. It happened in Sarajevo during the siege. That was the first war that I ever covered. It happened in New York after 9/11. I mean, a completely traumatized city here, right? 3,000 people were killed, and we all remember those terrible days. And yet the suicide rate went down in New York after 9/11. The violent crime rate went down. We treated each other better. We all felt like we belonged to something. We're not going to go back to a hunter-gatherer existence, right? We're not going to dismantle the suburbs and unbuild the cities and, you know, whatever. That's not happening. No one says it should. But one thing that we can do is try to instill a sense of unity and purpose in our nation. That's now the community that we're in. I think it's great to affiliate with your neighbors, and I actually met someone who experienced a murder in their neighborhood, and to his shock and dismay, there was no communal reaction to this terrible murder. This woman was killed. And he couldn't believe that nobody cared, really. And so he spent the next year sleeping in everyone's homes. Like, he went around systematically and asked if he could spend a day or two with every family in the community. And that was how he attempted to stitch together his particular community. That would be a great thing for people to do. And you don't need a murder to do it, right? You can just go do it. Sure. But at the national level, and this is, I think, the question we probably want to tackle, is like, how do we create a national identity that seems to encompass all of us and encourage us all to put in, to make some sacrifice for the common good. I mean, I think that's like a really crucial question right now.
And how to make veterans bond with each other outside of war? I mean, I would think that five veterans, let's say, opening a business together, and really, literally, their livelihoods depend on each other. I mean, I would think that this could be a an idea that could prolong the experience of belonging.
You're right, except that also one of the challenges is to help veterans transition back to society. So when you're, if you say to veterans, look, you guys, you're realistically, you're only going to bond with each other because the rest of the civilians don't know how to do it. It's a Band-Aid solution. And sometimes Band-Aid solutions are great. I mean, Band-Aids exist for a reason.
Yeah.
But the real problem is that there's no there's no society for them to reintegrate into, and that means there's no society for us to be integrated into either. It's really not a veteran problem. The veterans have problems because there's a societal problem, in my opinion.
Well, you talk about Israel that doesn't have this problem, and mostly because the citizenry there knows what it's like to be a veteran, and they know how to, you know, reincorporate their veterans into society. So I think, like, one of the problems within our culture is that individuals who never served really don't know what it's like and don't ask veterans, what is it like?
Yeah, and you are, yes, I mean, the PTSD rates are very, very hard to measure, and they're all over the place, and you can end up in quite an argument over what, you know, how, you know, levels of trauma. But
we found conservative figures saying up to 8% of the population at any given moment, so around 25 million Americans.
Right.
Of all kinds.
Right. But it depends on how you define it. With soldiers, the figure I've seen is 20%, some say 30, you know, I mean, right. And some say it's very low.
Yeah.
Personally, I think the figure is quite low, but there's this other percentage, which is a form of transition disorder and depression. It's getting put into the PTSD bin, but it's something else.
Comorbidity.
Yeah,
without necessarily the distress and symptoms.
Right. I mean, if you weren't in combat, you weren't traumatized.
Right.
You know,
right.
But a lot of people have difficulty coming home. The Israeli military has a PTSD rate as low as 1%. So they're doing something right. And as you said, some form of national service creates a kind of cohesion that is psychologically healthy for Israeli veterans.
Absolutely. Well, at some point, at some level, if we're not invested, you know, on a communal level, then what sort of community are we building? And that's why I think the notion of a national service could be a very good thing, not just for young people in this country, but for the country at large, in terms of not only beginning to work on some of the massive challenges that we face when it comes to infrastructure or what have you, but creating a more socially cohesive atmosphere. And that's, at the end of the day, what it is with sort of the platoons you mentioned, was it's this cohesion through mutual adversity, right? Is that it's the group sticks together because of this shared experience. And that may be what we're lacking here at home.
One thing we could do, I think, is probably penalize the people who are betraying certain of the ideals of our country. And you mentioned in the book about bankers and fraud and things that are betraying this code, at least of tribe, that holds us all together.
Well, it sends a very complicated message. If you're a soldier in combat and you do something that jeopardizes the safety, the welfare of the group, I mean, forget about the command structure. Your peers will rain hell down on you because you're endangering their lives. That has been the arrangement in human societies for 2 million years. There's a real conformity when it comes to selfish behavior. I mean, you don't act in selfish ways that jeopardize the group. Soldiers come back to a society where they watched a very small number of people on Wall Street, mostly white men, frankly, not to gang up on those guys, but that is the demographic, right? And they did things that were illegal and unethical and unwise, and they triggered an economic collapse that cost this country as much as $14 trillion. In any hunter-gatherer society, a small group of people that caused that kind of damage would be at the very, very least excommunicated from the group, if not killed.
Sure.
I'm not suggesting anything like that, obviously, but I'm just pointing out that when you can cause that kind of damage to your own people and get off scot-free, in fact, you can continue taking multi-million dollar Christmas bonuses at the end of this catastrophic year while your country is bailing out the companies that you ruined. When you do that, you send a message to the entire population that we're not really a country, that we don't actually have an entity that's worth sacrificing for and that knows how to preserve itself.
You're preaching to the choir, Sebastian. We talk about this on WBAI. We hear a lot about this, and I think many, many of our listeners will agree with everything you just said. I want to remind our listeners that you're hearing Sebastian Younger, our guest here today. He's the author of Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging, and it's a book about our society and how our society is structured and whether our society is even set up to really welcome home some veterans. But it's more than about veterans, and it's more than about PTSD. It's really a look at the structure of our society. We're learning more and more as time goes on about this condition known as post-traumatic stress disorder. And the name of it has changed over time, right? Back in World War I, they called it shell shock. And now we've gotten to the point where we call it PTSD. Kevin touched earlier on whether we should have the D in the end. Is it a disorder? Is that putting a judgment on it that maybe doesn't need to be there?
Well, I talk about this in my book a little bit. First of all, short-term PTSD is clearly adaptive in a situation of danger. I mean, if your life's been in danger, you want to do all the things that PTSD gets you to do. You want to react to unexpected noises. You want to be a little depressed. It keeps you out of harm's way, laying low. You want to be quick to anger. It makes you prepared to fight. You want to have dreams and nightmares about the thing that could kill you. So those are all adaptive behaviors in the short term. And I've had PTSD multiple times from my war reporting, and I've come home and had panic attacks in the New York City subway and all kinds of things that I didn't expect and didn't connect to combat, but it's exactly what it was. And after some weeks or months, it dissipates, as our biology would say that it should. And again, if trauma was incapacitating in a long-term way to most people, the human race wouldn't exist. So the disorder part, I think, is applicable when you have long-term PTSD that lasts years or a lifetime. That's not adaptive. That's not healthy. It is incapacitating. And for soldiers who have this, they apply for what is termed lifelong disability. The word disability seems to have much more negative connotations than disorder. And if we're going to call it lifelong disability, forget about the word disorder. That's a mild term in comparison. So if you want to play a sort of semantic game, there's other words to address first, actually.
Life sentence. Post-traumatic stress life sentence.
Well, the thing is, it really isn't. I mean, it's an eminently treatable condition there's nothing about it that is inherently a life sentence.
Right, but it seems like they are consigning themselves to accept themselves as disabled permanently for something that they really shouldn't. It's like an arm that gets injured and broken.
That's the power of language. I mean, you're getting soldiers, otherwise strong, vibrant, resourceful people, to define themselves as diminished. And, you know, when disorder, I mean, listen, if your PTSD reaction is keeping you from engaging in your life in an effective way, you have a disorder, right? But when you call it disability and say it and give and hand out lifelong compensation for it without tracking to see if there's improvement, you're basically sort of signaling, look, society doesn't need you. Like, we'll pay you $3,000 a month tax free. You can live off society. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your service, and we don't need you. And that's an unhealthy communication to veterans, right? I mean, there's an amazing painting by Winslow Homer that I found, and this is significant. It was painted in the fall of 1865. It was a few months after the Civil War ended. Is during harvest season, okay? And it shows a young man with a scythe, and he's harvesting wheat. And the title of the painting is A Veteran in New Fields. So this guy presumably finished fighting a few months earlier And he came home, and his community immediately put him to work. We need you. Well done on the war. Now we got to get the wheat in. And, you know, I think the people who really, truly are damaged and traumatized and incapacitated by war need to be cared for by the society. But then I think that's a fairly small number. And the other people, I think, even if they're struggling in transitioning back to health, it's an incredibly healthy therapeutic thing to do to have them participate in our society and make it clear to them, look, we need you. We can't do this without you.
And at the same time, giving someone $3,000 tax-free a month for the rest of their life is incredibly disincentivizing to have them, you know, wind up pursuing anything else.
It actually incentivizes them to amplify their symptoms.
Sure.
And to become a victim.
Exactly.
Of course, getting into victimization.
That's right. And that's terrible. It's terrible for the nation. It's terrible for them. And no one dares talk about it because it's so politically sensitive.
Did you look at statistics for PTSD after World War II? Because Americans came home and they literally built a country.
Yeah.
Well, so there was just probably no acceptance of PTSD.
I mean, the definition has changed. The standards have changed. It's sort of apples and oranges. But what isn't apples and oranges is the rate at which veterans apply for disability. Now, that's disability for psychological reasons and for physical reasons. But when you apply for disability, basically you're saying, look, I can't do this on my own. I need my nation's help. Please help me. And interestingly, the rate at which soldiers apply for disability has skyrocketed while the casualty rate has plummeted. I mean, war by war, the casualty rate has gone down, thank God, because the intensity of the combat has gone down from Civil War, First World War, Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, to the current wars. The casualty rates have gone down steadily, and the disability claims have gone up steadily.
Well, I have a relative who served in Vietnam, and what he's told me is that he believes that the casualty rates have gone down because a lot of guys who previously were so badly wounded that they would have bled out, there's now the technology to save them. Compared to, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s. And that's why there's more guys coming home who have lost a limb or who are disfigured versus the death rate.
Well, this is that's in the recent wars. This is a valid point. But a very small part of the military is actually in that kind of combat.
Right.
And most disability claims are for tinnitus, hearing loss, and PTSD, which are not life-threatening disorders.
If you're just joining us, this is The Positive Mind. We're sitting here with Sebastian Younger, author of Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. And we're talking about not just veterans, not just the military, but how our society is structured and what are really evolutionarily what we are inclined to sort of desire and thrive in, which is small groups of, say, 30 to 40, like a platoon. And that's why we have Sebastian Younger here with us today.
Linda, what do you have to say? What's your experience with, and thank you for being here, but this alienation of veterans coming home?
Well, it was funny, Kevin. I have a lot to say, and I'm so interested, and I'm so grateful to have you here with us today, Sebastian. It's funny, as I was walking from Penn Station here, I noted many homeless among the street, and one of them was a veteran, and I stopped to speak with him. So when we're speaking about alienation, you know, we see whether it's littering in the street or the homeless veteran sitting on the curb looking for money, I think it's the alienation that we're all suffering with right now. Mm. So whether we're looking at PTSD or post-traumatic, however, disorder. But I think it's, as you say, the alienation. People are afraid. People are scared. And that's what I'm hearing a lot of. So when we're looking at that cohesion that we do see, whether it's after 9/11, whether it's in the war, I think that that's something that we are becoming more and more aware that we so dreadfully need. And I think the political policy, the things that are going on right now, is highlighting this for me and for many people that I see. So whether it's coming back from war or going to war, I think it's that feeling of a culture, a fabric of society that we're all needing to feel part of and to feel safe. I'm feeling that that's most of the people that I speak with. It's a feeling of whether you're sleeping together or not, but it's a feeling of, am I in a family or am I in a relationship? Words like that are constantly being questioned. Where do I fit in? How do I feel safe? How do I feel comfort with others around me? So I think that it's that alienation that's really at the pivot of our very soul at this point in life and in this culture.
And you did ask him what you could do for him. didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did. I just felt that, you know, he was looking for some money, and of course but money was not what he was really looking for. He was looking for a conversation, and I always feel like that's an opportunity for me to touch base with another human being. And I explained to him that we were actually getting together with a few people, and we were going to be speaking about these kinds of things that he's suffering with right now, and how was he suffering? And he told me that he had a child, he had a fiance, he had a job, but that he didn't have money for various things. But it was really the conversation that I felt honored to have with this human being today. And he said to me, could you please just stop, and if you see me again, say hello, because I don't know that I'm going to remember you. So while we exchanged hands and handshakes, I felt honored that I was able to, at least in my world, feel safer that I was able to touch the heart of another human being. So, you know, I just feel that it's part of that, that we maybe, if we can become more aware of, whether we're throwing something down on the ground and littering or neglecting to just stop and kind of just say hello to one another, I think that that should be perhaps the start of something that could help us to grow from there.
And what helped you with your symptoms?
I think for most people, the symptoms go away in a matter of weeks or months. I mean, it's not that I haven't been changed by those experiences. Yeah. I mean, I still jump at certain noises or crouch. I crouch. And
But panic attacks, I mean.
Yeah, no, I mean, the things, I mean, I have reactions and I have emotional reactions to certain things. Yeah. But the things that you could call a disorder that are really negatively impacting my life, that stopped after a few months.
Okay.
I should say, just coming back to what you said, doctor, is that during my book tour, I actually started, because I'm talking about this, I started inadvertently collecting material that I actually wish I could have put in the book. And I think you'd recognize some of these things. I talked to one young woman who said that she'd had cancer, and that when she was sick, her family, her community, her tribe, her people, her friends, whatever you want to call them, sort of gathered around her to support her. And she beat the odds. She survived. And she looked at me very sadly, and she said, "Now I miss being sick." Now, if you're missing war, if there are people who have been imprisoned, who have been released, and they miss prison, if you have a young woman who misses cancer, you know, clearly society is not providing something crucial. That's obvious, right? And and so we actually don't need to pathologize that reaction and say, "Oh, you've been traumatized. What's wrong with you?" They're actually, for some people have been traumatized, but there's a lot of people who actually are having this kind of reaction who are having a very, very healthy reaction to this society. And I think, you know, if we can sort of stop and understand that, we could actually do an enormous amount of good in our society because it's not functioning very well.
You've cited figures showing a link between the wealth and technological advancement of a society and the rate of depression and suicide and the correlation.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, along with the enormous benefits of wealth and affluence and modernity, huge benefits, along with those, unfortunately, come alienation and depression. And so the suicide rate tends to go up with affluence in a society.
Sort of a postmodern malaise that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, community buffers people against depression and suicide. And the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to not need your immediate community in order to survive. And when you need people to survive, you're closely bonded to them. And however harsh the circumstances might be that are necessitating that, at least you're buffered against a sort of existential angst that people very easily fall into. I was talking to one woman whose father was a teenage boy in Italy when the Nazis rolled in. And the entire village that he was from moved up into the hills and lived in caves for a year until the Americans drove the Germans out. And this woman's father said that it was the happiest year of his entire life because there was no social distinctions. Rich and poor were all squatting around fires together. The entire village was up there in the caves, and they were there for a year, and he just loved it. I mean, and, you know, he effectively, that town had been pushed back into our evolutionary past, which is what we're wired for, and it felt good to everybody.
It's fascinating.
Even the cab driver you mentioned in Sarajevo or something said he missed the war. He missed how he was during the war.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I was in Sarajevo during the war 20-some years ago, and then last summer, for the first time since the war ended, I got to see that beautiful city sort of resurrected. And, you know, something like 15% of the city was killed by Serb forces that had besieged it during the war. It was an absolute bloodbath. Horrific. And this taxi driver that I had last summer, he said, we were talking about the war, and he said, you know, he was some kind of special forces soldier. And he said, look, now I'm just a taxi driver. And so, okay, I get it. You know, you're a macho young kid. You had this heroic role defending your city, and now you're a taxi driver. Of course, you miss it. You know, I get it. But then the next day, I met a woman who was a journalist, a woman named Nizara, who interviewed me. And then I sort of turned the tables and I said, listen, you're more interesting than I am. Can I interview you now? And I did. And she was a 17-year-old girl at the start of the war, and she pretty much ignored the whole thing until a Serb tank round smashed into her parents' apartment and almost took off one of her legs. And her father rushed her to the hospital, and they saved her leg. The surgery took hours. They saved her leg, but they had to operate without anesthesia to save her leg. Imagine what that felt like. And she said, last summer, she said, you know, as bad as it was, everyone misses the war. Now, she's not some macho soldier. She was a teenage girl who almost lost her leg, right? She said, we all missed the war because we were better people then. Mm. We lived for each other. And then the war ended, and we got some level of affluence, and now we just lead our selfish lives, and everyone's miserable.
Yeah, it reminds me of, well, you mentioned earlier 9/11 and the cohesion that happened here after that. I mean, we hear a lot of people wax poetic about how together this country was, how for a few months or however long it was, I don't remember exactly, but certainly for an extended period of time, there was a unity, and there was a coming together, and no one obviously wants to relive what happened, but the fact is that we were closer as a society, and we were closer together, and it's incredible that that's what it takes, and you almost wonder if that should be what it takes, if there isn't a better way for us to find a more cohesive way to live as such a large society as we are.
Do you have a response, sir? Mm-hmm. I was going to say, one thing you do talk about is that our future problems are going to be local. Can you say something about that? For instance, I'm thinking, like, look, we all need, this country needs a national commitment to something to get over this. And one thing, obviously, could be global warming or some national tragedy or catastrophe, like California going out into the Pacific or something. You know.
I mean, as long as we're organized as a nation, we have to figure out how to act in ways that support our sense of nationhood. So allowing people to destroy our economy without any repercussions for them diminishes our sense of nationhood. Yeah. The fact that I'll tell a brief story. My father grew up in Europe. He grew up in France. He came here during the war. He was half Jewish. He got here. He tried to join the military. He couldn't because he had asthma, and he watched a generation of American men, young men, go over and defeat fascism and save his country, and many of them died and are buried in France. And so when I grew up during Vietnam, I'm very liberal. Every adult that I knew as a kid was outraged by the Vietnam War. And so when I got my Selective Service card in the mail at 18, boys get a draft card. They still do. Girls don't know this. I mean, moms know it, but girls don't know it. Many of them don't. But boys get a draft card. And I got this thing in the mail. It was right after Vietnam ended. And I'm like, what the hell's this? It was 1980. I'm 18 years old. I said to my father, like, what is this? I'm not signing this, right? And he was a huge pacifist. And he said, no, you're definitely signing that. And he said, you don't owe your country nothing. You may owe your country your life. Hopefully not. But you don't owe it nothing. And the next war might be a stupid war. And then it's your moral duty to protest it. But it might be World War II again, and your country will need you. And then it's your moral duty to fight it. And he explained about the young men who were buried in France, the thousands of young American men buried in his home country. And when he put it that way, that you don't owe your country nothing, all of a sudden I was very proud to sign that card. And I understood, for the first time in my life, I understood the feeling of belonging to a nation. I loved it. It was thrilling. People want to be... They want to be necessary. They want to be needed. They want to make sacrifices. I mean, that's what young people want. It's like, tell me what to do. Just don't tell me this comes at no price. That's the worst conceivable news. If you don't sacrifice for something, then your status as a member of that group is insecure. As soon as you sacrifice for the group, your security in the group becomes more secure, and that feels good.
And you're invested.
And you're connected.
Yeah. Yeah, and the group's invested in you. Like, if you're not necessary, the group has no commitment to you. It doesn't need you. That's the tragedy of, in my opinion, that's the tragedy of modern society, is that we've gotten wealthy enough that we actually don't need the individuals in it. And that leaves the individuals wondering exactly how secure their lives are.